Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the coverage of the recent arrest of a would-be Muslim terrorist ready to carry out attacks here at home had a we've-been-here-before feel to it. Whatever questions might surround this particular case, most media consumers are by now accustomed to the general presumption that Muslim terrorism is a serious and prevalent danger. University of North Carolina Islam scholar Charles Kurtzman argues exactly the opposite in his recent book, The Missing Martyrs, Why There Are So Few Muslim Terrorists. He'll join us to talk about that. Also on the show today, some have been shocked to see that police clamping down on Occupy protests around the country have been treating reporters just like the hoi polloi, with scores of journalists arrested, sometimes roughed up, including some wearing clearly visible press credentials. While new attention to the problem is welcome, but activists should know that police efforts to restrict reporters' rights, along with those of others, are nothing new at all. There's history here, and it's not even ancient. We'll hear from author and Democracy Now! Producer and host Amy Goodman about one of her and her colleagues' own experiences of committing independent journalism. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
As was expected, the Congressional Supercommittee that was supposed to come up with a multi-trillion dollar debt reduction plan came up with no plan at all. ABC host George Stephanopoulos called it, quote, another failure that could affect every American, close quote. Correspondent Jonathan Carl agreed it was a colossal and embarrassing failure. Why, exactly? The overriding message in the corporate media was that the supercommittee was a test of bipartisanship, whether Congress would have the moral fiber to come together for the good of the country. And the fact that they did not was often explained as a bipartisan failure. USA Today referred to the paralyzing national debate, pitting, quote, Democrats who want to protect expensive social programs and increase revenue by raising taxes on the richest Americans, and Republicans who want to trim government and have steadfastly rejected tax increases, close quote. This is, as we've said before, misleading. Democrats were perfectly willing to make cuts to those expensive social programs, as some of them have said publicly for months. As New York Times columnist Paul Krugman put it, the media have failed to say who wasn't willing to compromise. Quote, if and when the supercommittee fails, virtually all news reports will be he said, she said, quoting Democrats who blame Republicans and vice versa, without ever explaining the truth, close quote. Unfortunately, he was right about that.
If media want to do just one big thing when they cover political campaigns, that thing could be to tell voters when candidates are lying. But there's a maddening, unwritten media rule against being so direct, even when the evidence is overwhelming. Texas Republican Rick Perry released an ad that features Barack Obama saying, "We've been a little bit lazy over the last few decades." To which Perry responds, "Can you believe that? That's what our president thinks is wrong with America? That Americans are lazy?" Well, rather unsurprisingly, Obama did not say that. The clip comes from him telling a bunch of business leaders he thought the government could do more to woo corporations to do business in the U.S. But press reports, like the one in the New York Times that said that Perry's ad takes a sharper tone than his earlier ones, hardly made that crystal clear. A later Times report was about as forceful as they get, suggesting that some of Perry's recent attacks have drifted into the realm of falsehood. Well, a few days later, Mitt Romney released an ad of his own, which included a clip of Obama saying, "If we keep talking about the economy, we're going to lose." Well, this one would get a high school student an F, since it's an edit of a comment from 2008 in which Obama was quoting someone from the John McCain campaign. The words right before the clip Romney uses are, "and I quote." Still, though this deception did raise some hackles, ABC's Jake Tapper and CBS Evening News called out the Romney campaign on it, the overriding media response seems to be reflected in the New York Times piece that called Romney's ad combative and a step up in the intensity of the campaign. The paper even seemed to reward it, saying it suggests Romney trying to show Republicans that he can take on Mr. Obama aggressively. Well, as long as journalists continue to treat deceit of the public as a legitimate strategy, it will be democracy that gets aggressed.
The news that Republican presidential contender Newt Gingrich received millions to advise mortgage giant Freddie Mac can't sit well with conservatives who are accustomed to blaming the government-sponsored Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae for causing the economic meltdown. But the blame Fannie and Freddie trope, which is a staple of right-wing media, has made it onto network news. Here's ABC News reporter Jonathan Carl on This Week on November 20th.
Newt Gingrich is riding high in the polls, which means now the spotlight turns to all his baggage. Exhibit A, the nearly $2 million he got from Freddie Mac, the government-backed mortgage company that made so many bad loans, it helped bring the economy down.
Now, in fact, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae don't make loans at all. And as countless investigations have pointed out, they did not play a central role in the housing crisis. The worst junk mortgages and subprime loans were bought and turned into securities by private institutions like Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Goldman Sachs. The two government-sponsored companies were actually late to the game, trailing the Wall Street wizards whose mortgage bundling wreaked havoc on the economy. If only Jonathan Carl was as well-versed on these facts as he is on right-wing propaganda.
On November 21st, New York Times reporter David Carr wrestled with questions about what the Occupy Wall Street movement might do next. Carr doesn't like the leaderless nature of the occupiers and doesn't care for their attitude toward the corporate media. Still, the movement has generated some important conversations about free speech and dissent, about which he wrote, quote, "There were citizens screaming invective about the rich while being confronted by the police and riot gear, the kind of spontaneous uprising we have not seen in almost half a century," close quote. It's hard to know what Carr can mean by this. There were massive protests against the Iraq War across the country. Right here in New York City, the police faced off with demonstrators at the 2004 Republican convention, arresting and detaining hundreds, often without charge. Is it the use of force that we haven't seen in 50 years? Hardly. Anti-IMF protesters in Washington, D.C. in 2000 were attacked by pepper-spraying police officers, just like we've seen in New York and Davis, California in recent days. It's encouraging that some journalists take the Occupy movement seriously, but it's troubling when they talk about demonstrators facing off against police in riot gear as practically unprecedented. Perhaps what they're really meaning to say is that those earlier attacks on free speech were woefully unreported.
And finally, Sam Husseini, who runs the news website Washington Stakeout and is a longtime friend of FAIR, was suspended for 2 weeks from D.C.'s National Press Club on November 15th. The charge? Boisterous and unseemly conduct or language. Husseini's crime might be more accurately described as attempting to practice hard-hitting journalism at a venue ostensibly devoted to the celebration of same. Husseini had attended a speech at the press club by Turki Al-Faisal Al-Saud, a leading member of the family that owns and runs Saudi Arabia and the former head of that country's intelligence service. During the question and answer period, Husseini asked about the legitimacy of the Saudi government, given that it is, as Husseini put it, quote, "one of the most autocratic, misogynistic regimes on the face of the earth," close quote. After a not particularly boisterous back and forth involving the event moderator and press club executive director William McCarran, the speaker answered the question, pointing out, among other things, that Saudi women will be allowed to participate in elections scheduled for 2015. Later that day, Husseini received notice from McCarran that he had been suspended. Since he had not actually been boisterous, one can only surmise that the press club believes it's unseemly to pose a tough question to a representative of a U.S. allied dictatorship. As Husseini has pointed out, the boundaries of behavior are quite different when an official enemy is speaking. The conflict might boil down to a disagreement over what the organization's name means. Husseini thinks it ought to behave as a national press club, whereas current management seems to put the emphasis on club.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
The recent arrest of Jose Pimentel in New York City was the kind of thing we're accustomed to being told to fear, an American Muslim who, with the few clicks of his mouse, could be radicalized by the likes of Anwar al-Awlaki and driven to plot terrorist attacks in the United States. The first wave of coverage of the arrest, like other similar cases, was followed by second and third day stories, raising serious questions about whether the suspect was even capable or whether the informant in this case pushed him to declare more ambitious terrorist plans. Whatever caveats might exist in the coverage, the notion that we're under a near constant threat of attack from Islamic terrorists is a constant media theme. But is it all wrong? Charles Kurtzman is a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina, and he's author of the recent book, The Missing Martyrs, Why There Are So Few Muslim Terrorists. He joins us now. Welcome to Counterspin, Charles Kurtzman.
Thanks very much.
This new case represents what might be a model for what we've been led to think about and fear about Muslim terrorism, how easy it is for Muslims to be radicalized and to go about carrying out an act of terrorism. A local newscast here in New York City called this a textbook case. The argument you lay out in the book, if not the title alone, must strike a lot of people as totally upside down. How can someone be talking seriously about how few Muslim terrorists there are?
I understand the title and the argument is counterintuitive and may even be upsetting to people because terrorism is quite real, and obviously there are real victims and have been. But the point that you quote, that this recent case in New York, how easy it is for people to engage in acts of terrorism, is also a point I think we should turn around. If it's that easy, why aren't we seeing more of it? Think back to the days and months after 9/11 in 2001. We were very concerned that there would be an explosion of violence, that there would be an escalation, spiraling out of control, terrorist activities. And now, 10 years later, that just hasn't happened. We've been very fortunate that this call for jihad, which is all over the internet, as you say, and can be accessed with just the click of a mouse, has not inspired more people to engage in acts of violence of this sort.
It's interesting, in the book you talk about how al-Qaeda leaders and other Islamists complain endlessly on the internet about how they can't find recruits willing to carry out acts, and they sort of goad other Muslims into being a real Muslim and standing up and striking against the United States. That said, and I think there are people in the particularly big-time pundits who will say, okay, there isn't a lot of Muslim terrorism, but they do find other themes, and you attribute one to people like Thomas Friedman from the New York Times, say, okay, maybe there isn't an explosion of Islamic terrorism inside the United States, but why don't Muslims more proactively condemn terrorism? That's a point that I think a lot of people who watch this discussion will say, well, surely that's correct.
No, it really isn't. It just means you're not looking for these denunciations. I've collected a bunch on my webpage, dozens and dozens of major Islamic organizations, virtually all of the major Islamic organizations and leaders around the world have denounced terrorism in no uncertain terms in their own languages for their own audiences. Now, these statements often have a caveat, an exception, where terrorist violence against Israelis is considered okay. But notwithstanding this double standard, there is a condemnation around the Muslim world against acts of terrorism outside of Israel. And Muslims have by and large, followed this advice. I mean, there's more than a billion Muslims in the world. The rate of Muslims who have been radicalized and engaged in membership in terrorist organizations or who have actually carried out acts of terror is quite low. According to declassified U.S. government documents and estimates, we're talking about well under 1 in 10,000 Muslims who have ever been engaged or affiliated with any of these radical organizations. In other words, that in the battle for hearts and minds of Muslims around the world, these anti-terrorist voices have been winning overwhelmingly. We saw this in the Arab Spring most recently. I mean, over the past year, right? We see mass crowds of Muslims out in Egypt and Tunisia and other countries, and even this week. And what are they asking for? It's not for attacks against the West or things like that. They're asking for democracy and rights, themes that we share with Muslims around the world.
There is some sort of confusion, I think, and the book also talks about this, about political feelings and terrorism. There's a mistaken idea that critical views of U.S. policy is somewhat similar or sometimes the same thing as support for terrorism. You write about a kind of radical chic that made al-Qaeda or the person of Osama bin Laden seem in some superficial way appealing to particularly to young Muslims only because the group or the individual in question was seen as standing up to a superpower. And I think a lot of people misinterpreted that as actual support or eagerness to engage in terrorism.
Yeah, there's widespread feelings of anti-imperialist sentiment among Muslims, and not just among Muslims, all around the world, of people who think that the U.S. has become a global empire. And regardless of whether or not you agree with that view, it is out there. It is very common around the world, but it does not lead to terrorism, at least not normally. There are tiny fringe groups that have engaged in acts of terrorism against U.S. targets on these grounds in Greece and elsewhere, and not limited, obviously, to Muslim societies. But this massive number of people who believe that U.S. foreign policy is unjust is producing very little in the way of violence against the United States. And some of the places that are most opposed, according to public opinion polls, most opposed to U.S. foreign policy are not the places that are generating the largest amounts of violence against the United States.
The interplay between terrorism and media coverage is something that is sort of crucial to understanding both because they feed on each other. Media pay more attention to terrorism, sometimes more attention than they should, and terrorists understand that media coverage is essential to their movements.
Yeah, this is something that's inherent to modern terrorism since the anarchists and nihilists pioneered the tactic in the late 19th century. Is that you want to go for a media-centric target, a target that will be reported widely in the news, whether it was newspapers or now television or the internet, because otherwise the only people you're terrorizing are the folks who are quite locally affected by the act of violence. But you can multiply that effect if you can get the media to spread the word. And so terrorists have been very savvy about picking targets and about leaking material so that the news media will cover them to a maximal extent. And so they are very interested in, the word implies, in generating terror, in generating anxiety, in generating news. And now the news media at the same time are also implicated in this because it's news. I mean, this is stuff that needs to be covered. If it wasn't covered, we would consider the media to be unprofessional. But of all the violence around the world that occurs every day, and there are hundreds and hundreds of murders every day all around the world, the ones that get covered and selected for international transmission and they're brought to our websites and they're brought to our newspapers every day are the ones that fit this overall narrative of Islamic terrorism and this global threat. And so we get, I think, a misimpression. If we just keep up with the news, we get the misimpression that Islamic terrorism is far more prevalent and is a far greater source of violent death around the world than it actually is.
Charles Kurtzman is professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina and author of the book The Missing Martyrs, Why There Are So Few Muslim Terrorists. Charles Kurtzman, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much for having me.
Human rights and press freedom groups have joined to protest the arrest and assault on journalists documenting the Occupy protests around the country. Scores of reporters have been detained, some physically harmed, but of course it isn't just the journalists themselves who are in danger. As the Committee to Protect Journalists notes, the disproportionate restrictions on access to the scene of the events, the arrests, and the criminal charges resulting from the performance of professional duties by reporters violate the right to freedom of expression. That's the right not just of those who would speak, but of those who would hear them. Denying reporters the right to bear witness is an act with deep meaning, and it's good that attention is focused on it right now. But just as inequality wasn't created by the most recent recession, police abuse of journalists is not new. Some reporters have long faced the issue of having just doing their job put them on the wrong end of the law. They're just not the reporters we hear from most often in the corporate press. Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman told the story of her colleagues and herself at the 2008 Republican National Convention when she spoke at FAIR's 25th anniversary event in April. Amy Goodman.
I just came back 2 weeks ago from the Twin Cities, from Minneapolis, with my colleagues. Well, Sharif had just flown in from Egypt, and he and Nicole Salazar, a multimedia producer, are heading back to Egypt this week and will be filing reports from us as the revolution continues to unfold. It is unfinished. We went to Minneapolis because we were being deposed by the police attorneys there. We have sued the Twin Cities police and the federal authorities for our arrests at the Republican Convention, September 1st, 2008. Maybe some of you were in St. Paul, but it was September 1st, 2008. It was a beautiful blue sky day. In the morning, it was right before the convention was going to begin in the afternoon. There was a protest march of some 10,000 people from St. Paul City Hall to the Excel Center where the convention was going to take place. The protest was led by soldiers, some in full uniform, which is very brave. Some who had been to war, others who were refusing to go to war, and then, of course, thousands of civilians from across the country and around the world saying no to war, and we were just covering that. And then when I went off to the convention center with Rick Rowley of Big Noise Films, together with Jackie Suen, they did Fourth World War, Zapatista, other films, great independent journalists. So we went onto the convention floor, and we were interviewing delegates from the hottest state, from Alaska, and and I got a call on my cell phone from Mike Burke, our senior producer, who's here tonight. And he said, come quickly to 7th and Jackson. Sharif and Nicole have been arrested. I think they've been hurt. I thought they were back in the public access network offices where we were doing our broadcast every day. We left the convention floor. We raced down the streets of St. Paul, about 20, 25 minutes. The whole area was cordoned off. And we got to this big old parking lot. Mike had given me the address. And I saw it was fully contained by the riot police that surrounded the parking lot. Inside, I saw people, it looked like a war zone, people with their heads bloodied, people were throwing up from tear gas, didn't know what had happened, but the area was fully contained by these riot police. So I ran up to them, my credentials around my neck, you know, that let me interview presidents and vice presidents and delegates. They're the top security clearance that you need to get on the floor of the convention. And I ran up to the police, and I said, I want to speak to your commanding officer. Two of my colleagues are inside. They're credentialed like I am. I had them around my neck. And I said, we have to have them released. It wasn't seconds before they ripped me through the line, twisted my arms back, slapped the handcuffs on, threw me against the wall and down onto the ground. I was saying, please don't arrest me. We just have to have our colleagues released. I was looking desperately for Nicole and Sharif. Couldn't see Nicole, but I saw Sharif across the parking lot, saw his arms behind his back. I demanded to be brought to him, was brought to him. I asked the police officer, because I couldn't feel my hands, if he could just loosen the handcuffs a little bit. He tightened them. So I was standing next to Sharif. We were saying loudly, we're journalists, you should release us now. We're journalists, you should release us now. Sharif also had the credentials around his neck, whereupon the Secret Service came and ripped the credentials from around our necks. So I was processed. I was charged with interfering with a peace officer, if only there was a peace officer in the vicinity. And I was taken into the police wagon. There was Nicole, her face bloodied. Sharif was bloodied on his arm. And she told me quickly what had happened. They'd been at the public access offices, SPNN. They saw a commotion outside. They raced, got the camera microphone. They raced downstairs, and they started filming. She was doing her job. She was filming the police and the protesters, but then it was just the riot police coming at her. The police were screaming, on your face, on your face. She didn't plan to film her own violent arrest, but that's exactly what happened. She had her press pass up. She was shouting, press, press. This is all captured on the film. And they came at her. They're saying, move. She's saying, where? She's trapped by the parked cars. And they're saying, on your face. And they took her down on her face. The first thing to tumble down was the camera. The first thing they did with it was pull the battery out of the camera. If you were wondering what it was, they wanted to stop happening. They wanted to stop the filming. They had their boot or knee in her back. She couldn't tell which it was. She was on her face, and they were pulling on her legs, so they were bloodying her face. Sharif was holding the microphone. He's a very cool guy, as you could see from Tahrir. And he was telling the police, the riot police, the rioting police, to calm down. They threw him up against the wall. They kicked him twice in the chest, and they took him down, bloodying his arm. He still has the scars on his arm. They were facing felony riot charges. So I was taken to the police garage where they erected the cages to put the protesters in, and they took Sharif and Nicole to jail. If it weren't for independent media, I don't know when we would have gotten out. It was hours. We didn't know it was happening outside, but people posted the video of my and Nicole's arrest online. And within a few hours, in the first 2 days of the convention, the most watched YouTube video at the Republican convention. I don't know how many thousands of calls, tweets, emails, faxes came in to the Twin Cities authorities, but I was released and then Sharif and Nicole released. Sharif was in jail with the AP photographer. He got out before the AP photographer. More than 40 reporters were arrested that week. Sharif was arrested again later in the week. I then was brought to the convention center because networks want to talk to me what happened. And I was in the NBC skybox and I described what happened. The camera was off. And an NBC reporter came over to me after and said, I don't get it. Why wasn't I arrested? I said, oh. I said, were you outside covering the protest? And he said, no. And I said, well, see, that's the thing. I'm not getting arrested in the skybox either. As Woody Allen says, 90% of life is just showing up, right? So it's our job to capture what's on the convention floor, to try to get into those corporate suites. Who's sponsoring the governor, Republican Governors Association in St. Paul? Who's doing it in Denver with the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee? And to go from the corporate suites into the streets, to where the uninvited guests are, the thousands of people who also have something to say. See, democracy is a messy thing, and it's our job to capture it all, and we shouldn't have to get a record when we try to put things on the record.
That was Amy Goodman, host and executive producer of Democracy Now!, speaking at FAIR's 25th anniversary. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can visit our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.